You on employment numbers? We will talk about Biden expanding access to health insurance for DACA immigrants. And we will talk about a January 6th Capitol officer seeking the nomination for Congress. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Don't miss it. It's a good one. You can sign up and get instant access at joinpacman.com. Well, welcome, everybody. The honeymoon is over and there is trouble in paradise. Donald Trump apparently already hates his new criminal lawyer and is reportedly furious with him, wondering aloud, why am I paying so much for this legal defense? This is, of course, relating to Trump's first of four criminal trials. This is all about Todd Blanche, Trump's criminal defense attorney. The New York Times has a very good article on this from a couple days ago. Trump venting about lawyer in his criminal trial seeks more aggression. Todd Blanche upended his career to represent Trump and has been the former president's favorite. But Mr. Trump has made him a focus of his episodic rash. We'll link to the article, but the number of things that Trump is displeased with is growing very quickly. Number one, behind closed doors and in phone calls, Trump is regularly complaining about Todd Blanche, according to four different people familiar with the situation. Trump isn't happy that Blanche isn't following his instructions for how he wants him to behave in court. He's not being aggressive enough. Trump wants his lawyer to attack witnesses. Trump wants his lawyer to attack the supposedly hostile jury pool. Trump wants his lawyer to attack the judge, Juan Merchan. And Trump has been wondering aloud, why do my lawyers cost so much money? And, you know, Blanche is accommodating some of these desires. Blanche has been, for example, in his opening statement, talking about how Trump built a very large and successful company. That's language straight out of Donald Trump's playbook right there. That is vocabulary right out of Donald Trump's regular refrain. Very big and successful company, and they went after me. And what's that other thing he always says?
I did everything right and they indicted me.
Exactly. So listen, Trump has a history of not paying lawyers. Hopefully Blanche, for his sake, not that it makes much of a difference to me personally, but for his sake, hopefully Blanche got some money up front. Trump has a long history of believing he knows more than every expert. Trump knows more than scientists. He knows more than epidemiologists and doctors and pulmonologists and immunologists and vaccine researchers. And he certainly knows more than generals, and he certainly knows more than lawyers, according to what he believes. And this is something that his lawyers have regularly, former lawyers have expressed as difficult with Trump. He tells you how he thinks you should be running the case. And sometimes the lawyers actually do know more. So what it is, this destined to implode before the end of this first criminal trial? I don't know. You would think that people will be able to get to Trump and say, listen, in the middle of a criminal trial at this level, firing your lawyer doesn't seem like the best idea. Unclear to me. But the reporting from The New York Times is Trump isn't pleased. He's not pleased. And, you know, sometimes you have a good lawyer, but the facts aren't on your side. And in those cases, usually the lawyers will argue process rather than facts. I don't think the facts are on Trump's side here. I think it's abundantly clear that Trump did the thing that he is accused of, whatever other arguments he wants to make in his defense. So we'll see where it shakes out. We'll see if we end up towards an appeal, if there is indeed a conviction. But Trump increasingly displeased with Todd Blanche. I don't envy Blanche. I mean, OK, I'm sure he's charging a bunch of money and maybe he's getting paid for some of it and he's sort of in the public eye. But dealing with Trump, trying to keep Trump awake. I mean, look at it's almost like a babysitting gig. They're trying to keep Trump awake by giving him papers to shuffle through and it's not working. He's sleeping anyway. I don't envy the guy. That's for sure. Donald Trump did hold some rallies on Wednesday, even though for weeks he's been saying, I'm busy in court when I should be campaigning. Then when he was off on Wednesdays, he would play golf. Well, this Wednesday, he actually did some rallies. Yesterday, we talked about the rally in Waukesha, Wisconsin. I do want to briefly discuss the rally that Trump did in Freeland, Michigan. He did both of these rallies on the same day. And again, even Republicans used to always say, no, the country is always great and we hope it does great no matter who's president. Trump opened his rally in Freeland, seemingly daydreaming waxing poetic about the economy plunging before November. He seems to be rooting for an economic collapse because he perceives it would be good for him.
Last week, we saw numbers showing clearly that the economy is crashing, with GDP growing and plunging and all over the place. Nobody knows what's happening, especially Biden.
Right.
But GDP growth was plunging.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We were optimistic when Hamas agreed to the ceasefire proposal. We were very optimistic. But Israel procrastinated, and it is going too far. They don't want to agree for ceasefire, and they want to raid Rafah.
There has been a response from Hamas to the hostage deal. We're currently reviewing that response, and we're discussing it with our partners in the region.
Even after Hamas accepted a Gaza ceasefire proposal Monday, Israeli forces moved in with tanks to seize the Rafah crossing with Egypt. Israel says the ceasefire deal falls short of its demands. Hamas has called for international intervention. We'll go to Rafah for reaction, and we'll get an update from the former Israeli peace negotiator, Daniel Levy. Then, more than 50 chapters of the American Association of University Professors condemned the violent arrest by police responding to peaceful pro-Palestinian campus protests. We'll speak with Dartmouth professor, former chair of Jewish studies there, Annalise Orlach, who says police body slammed her to the ground as she tried to protect her students. She was charged with criminal trespass and temporarily banned from portions of Dartmouth's campus. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinians in Rafah say they're trapped as Israeli tanks have taken over the crossing on Gaza's border with Egypt. The United Nations says Israel's denying access to the southern Gaza Strip through the Rafah crossing as aid groups warn of impending catastrophe amidst chaotic scenes of families fleeing with no safe option for shelter. The area came under heavy aerial bombardment again overnight as Israel vowed to continue its attacks on Rafah even after Hamas said it had accepted a ceasefire proposal advanced by Qatari and Egyptian mediators Monday. Israel rejected the ceasefire, but said it would send a delegation to Cairo for further talks. We'll go to Rafah later in the broadcast to get the latest from Palestinian journalist Akram Al-Sattari. A Guardian investigation found Israel used a U.S.-made weapon in the March 27th airstrike that killed seven emergency health care workers in southern Lebanon. Rights groups say the attack was a violation of international law. Gaza solidarity protests continue at college campuses across the United States, as does the police crackdown. On Monday, 43 arrests were reported at UCLA. At the University of California, San Diego, video shows a crowd of student protesters blocking a police bus from leaving with arrested students. This comes after UC Riverside protesters announced Friday it has become the first UC campus to reach a deal with the school to start evaluating its ties with Israel. At Harvard, students and faculty rallied Monday after the administration threatened mass expulsions for hundreds of arrested protesters. This is Issa, a Palestinian student at Harvard who's lost over 120 family members in Gaza.
Because she can't get medication for her blood pressure. On my entire arm.
Harvard professor Walter Johnson spoke to students in solidarity with their protest.
There's no room for a reasoned discussion about this action if Harvard will not disclose its investments in the occupied territories, in the Israeli military, and in Gaza.
Nearby, students from a dozen high schools in the Boston area joined the MIT protest Monday, as students there also defied a deadline to clear their encampment. Students at SUNY Purchase here in New York State celebrated late Monday as Gaza solidarity activists announced the school had met protesters' demands, quote, to disclose and cut ties with war crimes and genocide, unquote. Here in New York City, Columbia's canceled its main university-wide graduation ceremony May 15th amid mounting fallout from its mishandling of this protests. Students across New York and other protesters marched through city streets Monday, culminating in a rally near the glitzy, celebrity-filled Met Gala ceremony, where they were met with a heavy police presence. Student protests and encampments are continuing to spread around the globe as well, including in Denmark, where students have occupied Copenhagen University. In Spain, students at Barcelona University are also demanding their school divest from Israel.
We want to firmly condemn the genocide that is happening right now. And we believe that as Western people and Western young people, we have a privilege that we have to put at the service of the people who do not have a voice.
In France, high school students have started to join in the protest movement, organizing strikes and demonstrations. In Belgium, over 100 students have begun a peaceful occupation at Ghent University, demanding the school sever ties with companies connected to Israel's military and enact urgent actions to deal with the climate crisis. In related news, at least 132 climate activists were arrested Saturday in a peaceful blockade, calling on European governments to declare a climate emergency and end fossil fuel subsidies. Many of the activists glued themselves to the ground. The group Extinction Rebellion denounced excessive police violence against protesters, describing police actions as illegal and authoritarian. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, at least 12 people, including children, were killed in two bomb attacks on camps for internally displaced communities near the city of Goma. Congolese and U.S. authorities blamed the bombings on Rwandan forces and the M23 armed group. Rwanda has refuted the accusations, saying the assaults were likely carried out by militias backed by the Congolese army. Intensifying violence in the eastern DRC has forced hundreds of thousands to flee. The UN described the attacks as a, quote, flagrant violation of human rights and international humanitarian law, which may constitute a war crime, unquote. In Chad, voters went to the polls Monday in the Sahel region's first election since a wave of coups in recent years. Chad's current leader, President Mohamed Idriss Deby, is largely expected to win. He took power after his long-ruling father, Idriss Deby, was killed on the battlefield in 2021. 10 candidates were disqualified from the election, leading to a call to boycott the polls. Critics and opposition politicians have blasted what they call the dynastic dictatorship. Voters say they want a leader who can improve the dire economic situation in Chad and guarantee peace.
We need peace. We've suffered enough in this country. We want to change. We really want to change. Someone who can lead the country, who won't have the conscience to ignore the suffering of Chadian youth. Chadian youth are suffering. Our parents send us to school and we come back to fight in the neighborhoods. We're fed up. There has to be a change.
Chad is also home to over 1 million refugees, many of them from neighboring Sudan. The election results will take several weeks to be announced. In Moscow, Vladimir Putin was sworn in today for his fifth term as Russian president. Officials from the U.S. and many European Union nations were absent from the lavish Kremlin ceremony. This comes a day after Russia said it will conduct missile drills near Ukraine for the possible use of tactical nuclear weapons in response to threats, they said, by Western leaders. Moscow said the escalation is motivated by recent comments by French President Emmanuel Macron, who again refused to rule out sending French troops to Ukraine Ukraine, as well as UK Foreign Secretary David Cameron, who said last week Ukraine could use British weapons inside Russia. NATO blasted Russia's move as irresponsible. In Tunisia, hundreds of refugees, including children and babies, are missing after police raided and dismantled several makeshift migrant tent camps in the capital, Tunis, over the weekend. It's believed the refugees, mostly from Sudan, were forcibly taken and abandoned in the desert near the border with Algeria. Some of the babies were born in Tunisia from refugee parents. One of the encampments had been built in an alleyway outside the UN's International Organization for Migration office as refugees pleaded for help. In Haiti, at least 17 people have been killed after days of torrential rains and floods. Some 4,000 homes have been submerged in water as Haitians are already struggling with a spiraling economic and security situation. Much of the destruction is centralized in Haiti's northern region. Residents remain on high alert.
We sleep badly and we eat badly. Everything is complicated. For example, when it rains, we can't sleep. We have to stay standing because water flows below us, so everybody stays standing. There's no way we can lie to rest.
And the judge overseeing Donald Trump's criminal 2016 election interference hush money case in New York fined Trump another $1,000 for his 10th violation of his gag order and threatened him with jail if he continues to violate the order. Trump's been barred from publicly speaking out about potential witnesses and members of the court or the New York District Attorney's Office. Judge Juan Merchan said, quote, "The last thing I want to do is put you in jail. You are the former president of the United States and possibly the next president as well," the judge said. But Merchan concluded, quote, "At the end of the day, I have a job to do," he said. On Monday, the 12th day of the trial, the court heard from two Trump Organization accounting employees who laid out the paper trail of hush money payments to Stormy Daniels via Trump's former fixer, attorney Michael Cohen, who is expected to testify. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined in Chicago by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Palestinians say nowhere is safe in Rafah as Israeli forces carried out heavy aerial bombardment again overnight and moved in with tanks, seizing the Rafah crossing on Gaza's border with Egypt. The Israeli military released video showing soldiers raising an Israeli flag near the Gaza side of the Rafah crossing and a tank running over an "I love Gaza" sign. Over a million Palestinians have fled to Rafah since October 7th. Israel's war cabinet voted to move forward with its Rafah military operation Monday, even after Hamas said it had accepted a ceasefire proposal. Israel says the proposal, which was developed with mediators from Qatar and Egypt, falls short of its demands. At one point, Al Jazeera reported people in Rafah started celebrating upon hearing the announcement that Hamas had accepted the Gaza ceasefire proposal. This is a displaced child in Gaza, Malak, responding to the news Monday.
"We were optimistic when Hamas agreed to the ceasefire proposal. We were very optimistic. But Israel procrastinated, and it is going too far. They don't want to agree for ceasefire, and they want to raid Rafah. They dropped leaflets, and we don't know what to do or where to go."
Meanwhile, thousands of people rallied across Israel Monday night, calling for an immediate deal to release the hostages still held in the Gaza Strip, criticizing the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On Monday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller responded to questions about Hamas accepting the Gaza ceasefire proposal from Egypt and Qatar.
"The last thing I would ever want to do from this podium is say something that could put this very sensitive process at greater risk. We are at a critical stage right now. We got a response from Hamas. Now Director Burns is working through that, trying to assess it, working with the Israelis. I mean, my goodness, folks, I don't know that it gets any more sensitive than right now. And the worst thing that we can do is start speculating about what's in it."
That's White House spokesperson John Kirby. In a statement today, Hamas called for international intervention to push Israel towards a ceasefire. For more, we go to London, where we're joined by former Israeli peace negotiator Daniel Levy. He's president of the U.S. Middle East Project, was an Israeli peace negotiator under Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Daniel Levy. If you can talk about the latest that is understood about the ceasefire proposal, what Hamas has accepted, what Israel has refused to accept at this point, though they have sent a mid-level delegation to continue the negotiations.
With pleasure, Amy, as long as you let me just very quickly acknowledge that John Kirby and the White House have done very little from their podium except undermine the prospects of ending this war for the last months. So I think it's a little bit rich for the spokesperson, Mr. Kirby, to stand there and say the last thing I'd want to do is undermine it. You've done very little else for many, many months. If we are getting close, then why did you wait this long? Why have so many thousands of children died and suffered appallingly, along with all of the Palestinian civilian population? And why have those hostage families had to wait so long? Now, what's going on? What has been proposed? What has been agreed? There is a document that has been leaked. I cannot speak to its veracity, but I understand that it is certainly close to what we understand to be discussed. And there are two key components to this, Amy. One is this thing that we have been circling around for months now, which is, does a pause, a hostage release, a release of Palestinian prisoners being held in Israeli jails, does this represent the beginning of a sustained calm, a sustained ceasefire, an on-ramp to that permanent ceasefire? Or is this limited in time, duration, and then Israel continues to enter Rafah, carry out its assault on Gaza? If Hamas turned around and said, at the end of 40 days, we're going to launch rockets on southern Israel, I think people would say, well, that's a bit of a strange deal. But if Israel says at the end of 40 days, we're going to launch an assault on Rafah, then this is apparently a reasonable response. And that's the key thing. And I think what has happened this time around is that, in addition to testing each other, the Hamas and Israeli parties are testing the United States of America and the Biden administration in an unprecedented way. What do I mean by that? I think we've come this far because Hamas detects that the U.S. may finally be serious about offering a sustained calm, about guaranteeing, and it can't be ironclad, but at least credibly guaranteeing that they do not see a continuation of the war after 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 6 weeks. On the flip side, Prime Minister Netanyahu is testing, are the U.S. serious? Are they really going to hold off my weapons supplies? Are they really going to lay the blame at my door if I'm the recalcitrant party? Because that will be difficult for me to sustain domestically. We don't yet have the answer from the Biden administration in unequivocal terms. I think that will be crucial. That's the key question. Then, Amy, there are the details of the agreement, which will be hard to iron out. But if you've got this core question addressed of, are we really going to a ceasefire or are we going to a temporary pause? And unless it's the former, this can't be done. If we've got that ironed out, then one hopes that the questions around Palestinian movement inside Gaza, the questions around where the Israeli forces will be deployed, the questions around the entrance of humanitarian, desperately needed assistance, one hopes that all those can be thrashed out. If we got there, then there's implementation. Implementation will be difficult, especially if Netanyahu feels he can get away with slipping out of this and going back to what he clearly prefers, which is an even longer war, because that's how his politics stacks up.
And Daniel Levy, the BBC is reporting that a senior Palestinian official familiar with the ceasefire is claiming that Hamas has agreed to, quote, end hostile activity forever if the conditions of the truce are met. Do you place any stock in that report, or from what you're hearing?
I do not. Hamas is a political movement. It's an armed resistance movement. It has committed, I would argue, violations of international law. Israel was doing that before October 7th. So was Hamas. That has continued throughout this war. Hamas is also an idea in terms of resistance to permanent hostile belligerent occupation. I would take with extreme caution anything we're being told by a Palestinian Authority source. They're simply not part of this because they have marginalized themselves by becoming part of the furniture of the Israeli occupation. Unfortunately, today, it's hard not to see them as a co-opted authority. One, I think it's important to acknowledge that alongside condemning what Hamas did on October 7th, one has to acknowledge that the Palestinians have the right under international law to resist an illegal occupation. They must simply do so within the parameters defined by international law, just as Israel has a right to defend its citizens. That's its responsibility. But again, it must do so within the parameters of international law rather than violating, very plausibly, the Genocide Convention as set out by the International Court of Justice in its provisional ruling. So I would suggest that that kind of rumor mill is unhelpful.
And I wanted to ask you also about the protests, the continuing massive protests within Israel, even in, while the war continues. Your sense of the impact of these protests on the Israeli government?
It's a very important point, Juan. What I think we have seen is that the intensity of those protests, and those protests tend to center around the prioritizing of getting the hostages out, saying, do the deal, get the hostages out. The intensity, especially those led by members and family of those being held, by family, friends, those have increased. The volume, the extent to which this is disruptive and is impossible for Netanyahu to stare down, I do not think we are anywhere near that moment. And so you have to put these protests in the context of what is the internal dynamic in Israel? Is it a dynamic where Netanyahu feels he's run out of options? So there's a way of interpreting what's happening at the moment is that Israel has started, especially at the border crossing with Egypt, seizing a part of Rafah, a part of this area called the Philadelphia Corridor as well, as a last gasp thing so that the Israeli government, which feels it will have to agree to a deal, will be able to say, you see, it was this action which got them to accept slightly better terms. We did what we needed to do. That is the optimistic interpretation, that the pressure internally and externally is such that Netanyahu feels it's closing in on him. I do not think we're there yet. I'm not with that interpretation. I would like us to be there. The internal pressure is such that the soft opposition, who will run against Netanyahu in the next election, led by this guy Gantz, former chief of staff, former defense minister, and Eisenkot, they are still in the government. They have still not unequivocally said that if Netanyahu turns down the deal, they will quit. Even if they quit, Netanyahu has a majority. The street protests, courage to them, they're important. You even had, it was Holocaust Remembrance Day yesterday, you even had Holocaust survivors coming out and saying, not in our name, this isn't how one goes about remembering the Holocaust. And Netanyahu used this, as he has done throughout, in very scurrilous terms. But the pressure does not feel sufficient that Netanyahu's politics needs him to accept a ceasefire. He still thinks he can wiggle out of this, which is where the question of the external pressure becomes a key factor, because it's going to be that combination of internal and external. So I think the next question one would have to address is, where does the external pressure stand?
I wanted to go to another clip, this of U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
So I can confirm that Hamas has issued a response. We are reviewing that response now and discussing it with our partners in the region. As you know, Director Burns is in the region working on this in real time. We will be discussing this response with our partners over the coming hours. We continue to believe that a hostage deal is in the best interests of the Israeli people. It's in the best interests of the Palestinian people. It would bring an immediate ceasefire. It would allow increased movement of humanitarian assistance. And so we're going to continue to work to try to reach one.
And so if you can tell, he's referring to the CIA director, Burns, who is intimately involved with these negotiations. He's going back and forth. If you can talk about his significance. And when you talked about the role of the United States, how exactly has it stopped this from happening to this point, Daniel Levy?
Yes, I wish I could confirm that the U.S. has stopped this from happening. I mean, firstly, Amy, let's just go back to those scenes you showed earlier on. Palestinians in Gaza celebrating when the news came through of the Hamas acceptance of the terms of a deal. I think one can understand their celebrations, not only, of course, because of what they've been going through, but also they have been told, if anyone takes the United States government seriously, they have been telling us, Blinken said this in his last visit, they have been telling us that all it takes is a Hamas yes. So I think many of us would have been reasonable in responding, well, we got a Hamas yes, it's all done and dusted, isn't it? The reason that's not quite true is this was, I think one has to acknowledge, misinformation on the part of the US government. That this doesn't just depend on Hamas, it very clearly depends on the Israeli side, which I think most of the Israeli commentators at this stage are acknowledging that Prime Minister Netanyahu has constantly undermined these talks. And rather than being pulled up on this, being held with his feet to the fire by the US administration, they have failed to do that. Now, I think it matters that CIA Director Burns is still in the region, we understand, is directly engaged. Blinken has really not done a good job of this. I understand they play different roles. But one has to really ask this question, because that's the outside pressure. Will the US make it as near as impossible for Netanyahu to say no? If they fail that test, then Rafah will happen. By the way, it will almost certainly still be going on when Democrats convene for their convention in Chicago. I am not suggesting, and I think this is an important distinction to draw, Amy, I am not suggesting that the administration can click their finger and stop this. What I am saying is that a US administration that is willing to sustain a standoff with the Israeli leadership will place Netanyahu in a position where his military are saying, we just can't keep going with this. You already have burnout. Rafah will not be easy. The military side of this has not gone well. You will have a population increasingly saying, this is too much to put at risk, this relationship. And Netanyahu will have the hardest choice to make. And I think over time, he will have to succumb to this. There have been reports that some of the weapons transfers have been held up from the US to Israel by the administration. Those have neither been confirmed nor denied. If you want to get a ceasefire, they're going to have to be confirmed. That is actually going to have to happen. I imagine that some of this move towards a possible deal, move towards possible US seriousness in challenging Netanyahu, that we are not at the point of success yet. But some of the move towards that is a consequence of what you've shown us, what's going on inside the US, the pressure, the campuses. People should not feel disheartened. What they are doing is having an impact. The fear of how this could play out politically. And so I would say in these crucial moments, those efforts should be redoubled because they are meaningful.
And Daniel Levy, I'm wondering, the decision of the Israeli cabinet to urge Palestinians, 100,000 Palestinians, to leave eastern Rafah. Do you sense that this is also an attempt by Netanyahu to short-circuit a potential deal?
I would interpret it that way, yes, Juan. There are two ways people are looking at this. Is this a smart negotiating tactic to gain more leverage? I don't think that's worked with Hamas thus far. I see no reason to think that was the case. Hamas had already submitted its responses. The other way of looking at this is that it's a way of testing, prodding, can Israel get away with this? Can this prove to Hamas that we can do it, we are going to do it, there is no deal, and therefore Hamas will retreat from its position? I think that is a more reasonable reading, given everything we know about Netanyahu, everything he and his coalition have said. I'd love to think that this is a last gasp, and I hope that's how it plays out, but it doesn't look that way. There are three ways this can go. One, number one, this is something that Netanyahu cannot pull off. He feels cornered. He does the deal and it holds. That would be a precious thing. I don't think we're near that yet. The second is that Netanyahu says no, proves that he means no, this effort unravels. And then the question is, do the Americans, as they have done throughout, say, well, of course we have to blame Hamas? And I understand that for people to think that a Hamas negotiating position is more reasonable than an Israeli negotiating position, for those who follow mainstream American media, that's a hard disc to switch in your head. But that's the second option. The third option is the deal begins, but it unravels while it's being implemented. And if I could just zoom out for a moment, all of this is going on. We're talking about Gaza while the provocations in the West Bank continue to intensify. Every day there are disturbances there. It's not just settlers, it's the Israeli military. There are no settlers without the backing of the Israeli military, without the backing of the Israeli state. And we're still in an extremely uncertain time in the Israel-Hezbollah, Israel-Lebanon front. So all of this feeds into each other. And if this deal doesn't go through, I fear we're in for the much longer haul. And everything that you've reported on with such tenacity, and I give you credit for that, that has happened over the last months, I'm afraid will remain with us perhaps for an awfully long time.
And finally, we have 15 seconds. President Biden is giving what some are billing as one of the most important speeches of his administration, a speech on anti-Semitism. Daniel Levy, you're an Israeli Jewish former peace negotiator for Israeli prime ministers. Do you consider anti-Zionism anti-Semitism?
This is one of the most dangerous conflations imaginable. Desist from this now. We will fail in the struggle against anti-Semitism. We will fail to allow Jewish heterogeneity, which has been part of being Jewish throughout, the idea that one creed can be hegemonic and anything else is anti-Semitic, is an affront to Jewish history. Desist from this now, Mr. President.
Daniel Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator under Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. Coming up, we go to Rafah for reaction to Israeli forces seizing the Rafah border crossing with Egypt. Stay with us. Palestina by the Swedish group Shilat. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the Israeli military strikes Rafah in southern Gaza after Hamas agreed Monday to a ceasefire proposal, we go now to Rafah for an update on the situation there, including access to humanitarian aid. The White House said Monday a ceasefire does not have to be in place for a pier off of Gaza to be operational to bring in aid, but the pier's construction was temporarily paused last week due to bad weather. Israel seized the Rafah crossing on Gaza's border with Egypt overnight. This comes after Israel also closed the Karam Abu Salem crossing in southern Gaza this weekend after a Hamas attack killed four Israeli soldiers. For more, we're joined by Akram Al-Safari, the Gaza-based journalist joining from Rafah in southern Gaza near the Kuwaiti hospital. Akram, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what's happening on the ground right now? What does it mean that Israeli tanks have moved in, that they've seized the crossing with Egypt, and how are people responding?
Well, as a matter of fact, to start with, that means a lifeline has just been blocked. That means the movement of people who are traveling out of Gaza and people who are returning to Gaza has already been blocked. That means the patients who are in need to medical care and are transferred somewhere outside of Gaza are denied that access. That means the general population in southern Gaza and northern Gaza alike are deprived from the food supplies that were delivered and were even slow before this last development took place. And that people are talking, and ironically, they have been saying that Israel has been successful in two major military fronts yesterday. The major front number one is that they controlled Rafah border, which is a civilian facility that is in charge of facilitating the entry and departure of people into and outside of Gaza. And number one, that the Israeli army succeeded in destroying the I Love You Gaza banner, which means they have been out and about to destroy anything that has to do with life or love in the Gaza Strip. People are extremely worried. They understand that they will be greatly affected by that operation, and they understand as well that Israel has been playing that card for the sake of consolidating its position when it comes to the negotiations that are still underway between Hamas and between Israel, which is brokered indirectly by Egypt and Qatar, and with the supervision and support also of the American administration. The people in Gaza are afraid of the collective punishment that has been going on in Gaza North, and they see this move as a replication of the very same collective punishment techniques followed by the Israeli occupation forces, as they describe them, for the sake of just negotiating over the fate of people, weaponizing the food that people are entitled to as a human, weaponizing the health care and health supplies that are entitled to people as a human, and also weaponizing the shelter that has been destroyed. Yesterday, one third of Rafah population was asked to leave their homes and head to either to the very west of Rafah or to Khan Yunis and the Gaza central area. Tens of thousands of people are moving. Tens of thousands of people are still moving, and they are in despair, and they understand that more destruction, more devastation, more death and deprivation is coming for them. So this is the overall atmosphere in Gaza. People are afraid. People are skeptical about the real intention of the Israeli army or for the Israeli political level to engage in negotiation, and they understand that they have been doing all they have been doing for the sake of undermining the possibility of living a decent life in Gaza and for the sake of just pushing towards an ultimate objective and goal of the transfer of people of Gaza after rendering Gaza inhabitable.
And Akram, I wanted to ask you, all of this comes as Israel banned over the weekend Al Jazeera from reporting in the country and raided the Al Jazeera's Jerusalem bureau. So many reporters and Al Jazeera reporters have been killed since this this war started. Do you fear that this is an attempt to stamp out any reporting from Gaza just before this new potential invasion of Rafah?
In general, the Israeli army and the Israeli political level are so fed up with the performance of all different media outlets. But the irony when it comes to Al Jazeera is that they have been talking about the freedom of expression, and now they are just banning Al Jazeera from transmitting the news bulletins from their, what they call their soil. They have killed so far 149 journalists. and they have been chasing different news outlets, including some of the review of the materials and of the news bulletins that are provided by the reporters on the ground, and then going after those reporters that might be providing some different narrative than the narrative that they want to see on the ground, that they want to see reported to the people and to the public. So the situation is extremely catastrophic, and I think they want to silence Al Jazeera, and they want to silence all the free media for the sake of preventing any further exposure of the things that are happening on the ground. Those things that include wiping out of whole families, destruction of very critical plants and facilities that are intended to purify the water that is going for the people who need them, and that's why people are suffering from severe health symptoms and problems, including upper respiratory systems, digestive systems, and all different type of health issues. Israeli government proved by its performance that they have been after the freedom of expression, and that they're willing to take an extra mile when it comes to banning that voice from going out for the people. And by banning Al Jazeera, they are supporting the analysis that they have been fighting against freedom of expression at all different fronts and levels.
Akram Nosatri, the issue of aid coming through. You have the World Food Program saying, that's Cindy McCain, saying that the North is in full-blown famine. Then you have the UN saying Israel's denying access to the southern Gaza Strip through the Rafah crossing as aid groups warn of impending catastrophe amidst chaotic scenes of families fleeing with no safe option for shelter. Can you talk about the aid situation right now as the closing of another border and how people are getting aid at this point?
Well, the aid has been extremely slow for the last few weeks or so. People were affected, and the people were struggling for the sake of stockpiling, if that is the right expression. The right expression is to get any kind of food that they can serve their families on a daily basis. And the ones who were seeing that ground operation coming were hopeful that they would stockpile some of the food for the sake of just using it when they move from Rafah, because they were foreseeing a scenario within which the very same almost famine in the Gaza North would be replicated in the Gaza South. Now, with the very slow entry of the food, they could not store anything. And the blockade now that has been imposed on the Gaza South, which is a blockade by the literal meaning of the word. Now, Israel is controlling the Rafah border. Israel is controlling the area of Kerem Shalom. Israel is not allowing the entry of the humanitarian aid to Gaza, which is perceived as a lifeline for the people of Gaza, who lost their livelihoods, who lost their shelters, who lost their deeds, who lost almost everything, but they're still willing to live, and they need that food to live. Now this food is going to be denied. They are going to be denied access to that food, and that is likely to aggravate the humanitarian crisis that is unfolding in the Gaza Strip. The fear that has been voiced by the UNRWA, by the World Food Program, by the United Nations Development Program, by the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, which is a UN organization that is in charge of observing the situation and supervising and reporting about the situation. Technically, all the international organizations have been working about such a move that is likely to have a catastrophic impact on the life of Gazans. This catastrophic impact has already started last night. When the Rafah crossing was stormed, Kerem Shalom was stormed, people entered the area, were trying to get anything that they can get, anything they can put their hands on. Now, no food supplies whatsoever that are coming from the Rafah crossing or from the Kerem Shalom. That is likely to affect people. Today, it is affecting people. And it will affect them in a much worse manner as time elapsed, because Israel would stay in that area, and then they would resort to some nominal measures to show the world that they have been allowing food aid into Gaza. Gaza needs 1,000 trucks of food aid, of food supplies every day. Gaza has been receiving, in the very first days of the crisis, 5 trucks, 6 trucks, 10 trucks, 30 trucks, and Gaza in the recent days before the Passover was receiving around 230 trucks, still below the minimum, but now there's nothing, not even the minimum or nothing else, and Gaza is likely to continue suffering, and I think that is going to bring about more hunger, more starvation, and more death and suffering.
And Akram, I wanted to ask you, you're aware of these massive protests of students across the United States and Europe and other parts of the Western world in support of the Palestinians. Has news and information about these protests reached the people in Gaza, and are they heartened by some degree by the support of the young people in these countries?
Palestinians have been extremely grateful following the news about those major protests in all different, like American universities, in support of people of Palestine. Palestinians have been very grateful for the Jewish voices for justice and peace, who have been galvanizing people into action. They have been following the news. Our the people who have been the culprit of that ongoing, they see it as an uprising, and they call it Intifada, after the name of the Intifada, the uprising that started in 1987. And they are grateful, they are hopeful, and they are extremely positive about that. And they hope that this kind of activism is going to lead the American, to prompt the American government to reconsider its positions from the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and from the Gaza crisis. They're hopeful that this dynamic movement all over the United States is going to also line up more people in support of the Palestinian cause and in support of the right of the people of Palestine to live a dignified life. They want a ceasefire, and they think that this kind of action is leading and is paving the way to a ceasefire by pushing the American administration and by opening the eyes of the public. So it has the component of educating, it has the importance of advocating, it has also the operating level where they have been talking the talk, walking the walk, extending the helping hand, changing the dynamics in the hope something positive would happen. And personally, I see many positive things happening in the United States thanks to the efforts of the university students, thanks to the efforts of the humanitarian community, and thanks to the efforts to the Jewish voices who have been there for the, in support of Palestine and in support of humanity and justice. This is the perception of the Gazans, of the things that are happening. Gazans are amazed, Gazans are grateful, Gazans are hopeful that this kind of action would continue and would lead to something bigger and more positive and sustainable, including the sustainable ceasefire.
Akram al-Sathri, we thank you so much for being with us. Gaza-based journalist joining us from Rafah in southern Gaza. Next up, Gaza solidarity encampments continue. We speak with a Dartmouth professor who was body slammed to the ground, former chair of Jewish studies at Dartmouth. Stay with us.
Yeah. The people, they won't leave. What is threatening about divesting and wanting peace? The problem isn't the protests, it's what they're protesting. It goes against what our country is funding. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. When I was 7, I learned a lesson from Cuban Eazy-E. What was it again? Oh, yeah, the police. Actors and badges protecting property in a system that was designed by white supremacy. But the people are in the streets. You could pay off Meta, you can't pay off me. Politicians who serve by any means. APAC, Koofi, and all the companies. You see, we sell fear around the land of the free. But this generation here is about to cut the strings. You could ban TikTok, take us out the algorithm. But it's too late, we've seen the truth, we bear witness. Seen the rubble, the buildings, the mothers and the children. And all the men that you murdered. And then we see how you spin it. Who gets the right to defend and who gets the right of resistance? It's always been about dollars and the
Hins Hall by Macklemore. The song just came out, announced that all proceeds from the song go to UNRWA. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at how Gaza solidarity encampments are continuing at college campuses across the U.S. despite brutal police crackdowns. In the latest roundup, at least 43 students were arrested Monday at UCLA. The Intercept reports after New York police raided Columbia University encampment last week, some of the arrested students were denied water and food for about 16 hours. Two protesters were held in solitary confinement. On Monday, Columbia canceled its main university-wide graduation ceremony May 15th, amidst mounting fallout from its mishandling of the peaceful protests. Meanwhile, Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner visited the University of Pennsylvania Gaza Solidarity Encampment last week to speak with organizers and legal observers.
The First Amendment comes from here. This is Philadelphia. We don't have to do stupid like they did at Columbia. We don't have to do stupid. What we should be doing here is upholding our tradition of being a welcoming, inviting city where people say things, even if other people don't like them, because they have a right to say it in the United States, and where protesters also have an obligation to remain nonviolent and to engage in speech activity and in activity that does not become legal.
That's Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner at the encampment at UPenn. This comes as more than 50 chapters of the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP, have issued a statement condemning the violent arrests by police at campus protests. This includes our next guest, Dartmouth professor, former chair of Jewish studies, Annalise Orlik, who says police body slammed her to the ground as she tried to protect her students when officers in riot gear cleared the peaceful encampment on Dartmouth's campus. Annalise Orlik is a professor of history, women's gender and sexuality studies, former chair of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College, where she's taught for more than 30 years. Professor Orlik was among dozens of students, faculty and community members arrested at the Dartmouth encampment last week. She's been charged with criminal trespass and temporarily banned from portions of Dartmouth's campus. She's joining us now from Thetford, Vermont. Professor Orlik, thanks so much for being with us. Can you take us through what happened that day? Where were you? Why did you decide to go to this encampment? And then what happened?
We were concerned that the students might be subject to some kind of violence, to—I didn't really think there was going to be arrest, but I didn't know for sure. The institution had sent out a very strict list of do's and don'ts earlier in the day, and it was clear that they were going to try to break up the encampment as quickly as possible. So there were a whole bunch of us, there were dozens of faculty out there to try to support them, and I was in a line of mostly older women, most of us Jewish, and the riot police came at us and started trying to literally physically push people off the green. We were standing in front of our students, between the students and the riot police, in the hope of preventing violence. That didn't happen. My students and I were subject to really violent handling in the course of our arrest. And it's possible that I was subject to the most violent handling.
What happened to you?
I was videoing my students' arrests. I was telling the police, they're just students, they're not criminals, leave them alone. And suddenly I was body slammed from behind by these very large men in body armor, and hard enough that my feet left the ground for a few seconds. I landed on the ground in front of the protesters. They had taken my phone, and so I got up to try to demand my phone, and then they grabbed me under the arm, slammed me to the ground, dragged me face down on the grass. You know, one guy had his knee on me. And honestly, Amy, I heard myself saying what I'd seen in videos so many times: you're hurting me, I can't breathe, stop. And they said to me what they've said to so many victims of police brutality: you're talking, you can breathe. They then put on the zip tie cuffs on me, on a colleague, my colleague, Christopher McEvitt, and on many of our students so tightly that people have nerve damage, compressed nerves, severe pain. So that's what happened to us that night. And the university has not dropped charges for criminal trespass or even asked the DA to drop the charges. So we are all banned from the Green, which is the center of campus, from the administration building where we would go to protest, and from the street on which the president's house stands.
And Professor Orlik, the faculty met with the Dartmouth president yesterday, Monday. Could you talk about what was discussed and what was the message of the faculty to the administration?
The message of the faculty was drop all the charges now, apologize for the harm and trauma you've inflicted on the campus, promise that there will be no riot police called to campus again, change your policies on protest to be less restrictive, and, you know, to acknowledge constitutional protections on free speech, and get rid of the Palestine exception to free speech. People have to be able to talk about Palestine without being attacked by police with clubs, gas, and God knows what else.
I want to ask you, Professor Orlik, you're a professor of history of women's gender and sexuality studies, former chair of Jewish studies. President Biden is going to be giving an address on anti-Semitism today, issuing what they say is a clarion call to fight swiftly rising tide of anti-Semitism across the United States, and especially on college campuses. I put this question to the Israeli peace negotiator Daniel Levy as well. But if you can talk about whether you see this rise and also the equating of anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism and the number of Jewish professors and students who are part of these protests.
Yes, I think this protest movement has a large and disproportionate percentage of Jewish students and faculty involved, because we all feel very strongly that we don't want this genocide in Gaza in our name. And I was really struck by the fact that there was some reporting, I think, by The Guardian and BBC that I heard today, that the people stirring up a lot of trouble and saying things outside the gates at Columbia were tied to the Proud Boys, that there were people who attacked the protesters at UCLA so violently and who had ties to Trump rallies. And I think it's deeply ironic, deeply, deeply ironic that the House Republicans who supported the January 6th assault on the Capitol, in which people were wearing Camp Auschwitz shirts and shirts with a logo that says 6 MWE, 6 million wasn't enough, and that they have become the defenders against anti-Semitism. I heard nothing. There were Buddhist, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish chaplains at our protest. The students were singing, they were chanting. Yes, there was some of the River to the Sea chant that many Jews find so offensive and believe is a call to genocide. I accept the interpretation made by my Palestinian colleagues and students that this chant is about equality from the River to the Sea and freedom. So I don't see any anti-Semitism, and you should know that many Jewish faculty at Dartmouth signed a letter insisting that the president not speak in our name and not use anti-Semitism to rationalize bringing these violent forces onto our campus.
And Professor, your message to the students who've led and organized these peaceful protests for months, despite all of this repression?
Well, my students are holding another rally today on one of the parts of the campus we're not banned from, which is the grass in front of the library. And I think their bravery is tremendous and it's inspiring. And they really feel like this is the moral issue of their time, that there's a genocide going on and that they can't ignore it. And again, I have colleagues at Columbia, colleagues at UCLA and in many parts of the country who have been not part of the encampments, but have visited the encampments, have spoken to the students there, have not felt threatened, have not felt anti-Semitism. Certainly at Dartmouth, we didn't. And there's a very powerful open letter from a Christian pastor who was there who's saying the same thing. So stop weaponizing anti-Semitism. It's offensive and it's wrong.
Finally, Professor Orlik, how are you right now, having been beaten to the ground? And also, you're banned from your campus where you've taught for over 30 years, parts of it?
Yes, I was initially, as a condition of my bail, banned from the entire campus, but the college insisted that was a clerical error and, gave lie to their argument that they can't get, charges changed or dropped by calling the local police department and getting them to change my bail so that I can teach. So I can now teach, but my building is on one of the streets that I'm banned from. So I was having to run up the street yesterday in sunglasses really quickly, trying to get to my class, and not get arrested. It's ridiculous. And the green is the very center of our campus. We all cross it many times a day. My kids grew up playing on the green. The idea that we can't have access to the beating heart of our campus is offensive again. And, just gives a sense. The president makes this argument that she's trying to ensure that the green is open to people with all views, and that, the five tents and 10 students who were camped out there would make the Green a place that only people of one view could be. Honestly, I think that's what they did by making making us frightened. I'm still hurting. I have nerve damage in my wrist. I have an injured shoulder. I have bruising and swelling, and it's very scary. And I'm getting better, but it's crazy that I should be in this position for trying to protect my students. And I say the same for other faculty who are out there, including Chris McEvitt, my colleague on the faculty, who was also arrested and also harmed.
Annalise Ehrlich, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of history, women's gender and sexuality studies, former chair of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College, where she's taught for more than 30 years. Professor Ehrlich, among dozens of students, faculty, community members arrested at a Dartmouth encampment. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
My name's DJ Tony Tunes. And Anthony Cacciato, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, I did accidentally give you my secret identity there. But, you know, it's all good. I mean, do a little bit of both. Do a little bit of the music, do a little bit of the talking. I'm sure if you listen to both, it's a little obvious. I sound exactly the same there. But just before we do get into the mix of things here, wanted to let you know that everything that's said on this program today is just the views of myself and my guests, and not necessarily those of WRCT or its members. So without further ado, I'm going to run right into this episode of The Angry Young Man, where today I am very glad to have a friend of mine, the map boy, as he was very affectionately called a couple of years back, but also student senate president, as of not too long ago, not the case anymore.
Only for six more hours, and then I'm free.
Six more hours. Yeah. So, this is Kyle Hines, the lame duck Senate president. I'm saying that's a little
it's accurate. I'm a lame duck.
Yeah, no, but welcome to the Angry Young Man, another Billy Joel appreciator. Who, for those of you who are not Billy Joel fans, this is named after a Billy Joel song, The Angry Young Man, the song that we start off with every single Thursday. Welcome to the program, Kyle.
Thank you, DJ Tony Tunes. It is an absolute pleasure to be on.
It's Anthony Cacciato for the purposes of the show.
Is it Mr. Cacciato? We'll go with that one.
Mr. Cacciato, very Cacciato,
the angry young man.
Very formal of you there. The thing we're going to talk about today, we were talking a little bit about what we wanted to do, and we ended up settling on a wonderful, very relevant piece of current affairs, foreign aid. For those of you unaware, over the weekend on the 20th, the House of Representatives passed several bills, three of them being aid packages to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, respectively, amongst a myriad of other things they passed that day. A lot of people very happy to see that Mike Johnson delivered on that, working with a coalition of Democrats and Republicans. But a lot of Republicans also not too thrilled to see more American taxpayer money sent abroad, especially without oversight. So, I mean, this is kind of your bread and butter here, Kyle, from my understanding.
Not quite my bread and butter, but I got some thoughts on it, and I'm sure you do too. So it'll be a wonderful conversation.
I mean, we'll start you off here. I mean, it's as is the usual angry young man courtesy. What's your take? What do you think?
Well, look, I think that first of all, the aid package that went to Ukraine is absolutely fantastic. I think it's a long time coming. Speaker Johnson certainly stretched it out to the very last minute when he could have done this without harming Ukraine's defenses. But no, I think it's critical that we get that money to Ukraine. They're an ally of ours. They have signaled their intention to be a part of the West. They want to join NATO. They want to join the European Union. I think in the long run, we should absolutely encourage it. And Vladimir Putin on the 24th of February, 2022, gave us the biggest break in the rules-based international European order that we've seen since the Second World War. And I think it's important that we fund our allies so that they can protect against that.
So I guess the question that kind of comes out the gate, specifically with Ukraine, but also as a general thing, as it relates to just any foreign aid, why is it in the interest of American taxpayers to okay their funds being sent abroad, especially when we have very pressing domestic issues?
Well, I think the most important part that we need to remember here is that we're human beings first and Americans second. And absolutely, it's important that our taxpayer dollars go to American interests. But I think that we should also understand the humanitarian aspect of it. We don't want to allow 44 million Ukrainians to be overrun by a despot and a madman in Vladimir Putin. And we don't want them to be subject to a dictatorial regime.